91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we discuss the book Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs, with its author, educator, and journalist, Dr. Michaela Haas. Good afternoon. It's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Dr. Haas documents the new science of post-traumatic growth and looks at how severe trauma survivors not only find healing and new resilience, but how and why such a crisis can launch a more meaningful life. 9 out of 10 Americans experience at least one traumatic event in a lifetime. How did it affect your personal outlook? We'll find there may be a genetic link for survivors who best adapt and even flourish. That's Topical Currents up next after NPR and regional news.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Monday. Bonnie, perhaps a slight touch of fall in the air?
Yes, there is.
Maybe a little. We have hope.
We have hope. At least it's not off the charts in the 90s with 99% humidity. Well, this hour we visit with Dr. Michaela Haas, whose professional and personal life has centered on post-traumatic growth. She's a journalist, TV host, author, and scholar.
And this hour we'll discuss Dr. Haas's latest book, Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs.
And she joins us from Malibu, California. Welcome to you, Michaela.
Thank you so much for having me. I love NPR. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it's our pleasure. Thank you. So you've borrowed from Maya Angelou, Western psychology and science, Eastern wisdom, even the U.S. Army for this book. Mm-hmm. So let's begin there. How do all these disparate elements kind of work together?
So what surprised me the most in the research was the question that guided me was, how do some people manage to not only survive after a bad break, but actually thrive? And what surprised me so much was that all these different people, from soldiers to artists to surfers, that they found very similar strategies that helped them. So, for instance, I went to the Army Resilience Boot Camp because I figured the Army is the organization that has the keenest interest to find out how we survive traumas and how we manage to heal after them. And when I got there, the thing that surprised me was that the first thing they learn when the soldiers get to the resilience boot camp is to admit weakness, to learn to ask for help. So it's not the image of the invincible soldier, but it's actually the opposite. It's being vulnerable and admitting our own vulnerabilities. So that was one thing that pretty much all the people I talked to have in common, that they were not afraid to go there where it hurts and look at that.
That Army business kind of struck me in that the Army is trying to be proactive on PTSD.
Yes. Well, as you know, every day 22 soldiers commit suicide. So this is right. Extremely urgent, and we need to figure out fast and urgently how to deal better with traumas. But in my book, I not only talk about the big capital T traumas, the traumas of, you know, the war in Iraq or the really life-threatening, life-crushing events, but also everyday traumas can pull the rug out from under us. You know, a divorce, losing a loved one, being diagnosed with an illness. I mean, hardly any of us go through life without experiencing at least one or more traumas.
I just wanted to add that not long ago, we had two Iraqi war veterans on the show. They were a group of four. They had done this spoken word theater called Conscience Under Fire. Mm-hmm. And they have little pins on them that says post-traumatic stress, but the stress is crossed out, and they have post-traumatic growth.
I saw that. That's fantastic.
Who coined this term?
This term was coined by two trauma psychologists at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun. And they coined that in the mid-90s. And it wasn't that they came up with a fancy term and then went about proving it. It was the other way around. They were working with their clients. At first, it was people who had lost a loved one. It was people who were dealing with an illness. And they were surprised again and again that people told them, you know what, I'm not glad that this happened to me, but all things considered, I became a better person because of it. I found new perspectives in my life because of this terrible thing I went through. One client told them, I'm glad that I'm paralyzed. And Richard Dedeschi went like, what? Are you serious? So they knew that they were onto something because people kept telling them this again and again. And so they started researching it. And what they found is that 30 to 70, in some cases up to 90% of people experience post-traumatic growth. So this is not the opposite of post-traumatic stress. It doesn't mean that people are not experiencing stress or aren't sad or aren't upset or aren't suffering. But the stress can serve as a catalyst for growth, meaning we can take these bad breaks, these tough things that inevitably happen in our lives, and use them for a greater good. We can use them to grow.
So the big picture, why do some of us wilt and some thrive in adversity? And of course, it depends on the adversity. What might shatter me might be survivable by Bonnie.
It depends on the adversity, but you know what's interesting? Up until recently, psychologists thought it was the severity of the trauma. It was what happens that decides on how severe the post-traumatic stress is. And now they're finding more and more that it's actually how we respond to it that decides of how severe the stress or how the outcome is. So meaning, you know, for some of us, a divorce can be a relief. For some of us, it can be the end of our world. For some of us, going into war can be the most devastating thing a soldier ever does. For others, it's the most exciting things in their life or their most meaningful mission. So it doesn't so much actually depend on what happens to us externally. It's what kind of meaning we find in it and how we respond to it, and also very much on who's there for us.
And that's a very important point that we're going to get to, because that, you say, is one of the most important things.
Yes.
How did you choose? One of my heroes is Temple Grandin. You write mm-hmm. about Temple Grandin and many, Brigadier General Rhonda Cornum. How did you choose? And I'd like to get to some of their stories. How did you choose them?
So Rhonda Cornum was an easy one because she is actually the one who initiated the Army Resilience Program. And she did that because of her own experience. She was captured in the first Iraq War. Her Black Hawk helicopter was shot down. She survived, badly injured. She had a near-death experience. And when she crawled out of that helicopter, she was surrounded by several Iraqi soldiers who took her hostage, sexually assaulted her, and basically threw her in a bunker. Both her arms were broken. She could do nothing. She couldn't even feed herself, let alone defend herself. And when she came out of that experience, she was released after a week, because luckily the first Iraq War didn't take very long. So when she was released, all the Army psychiatrists were like, how damaged are you? Are you going to survive this trauma? And she surprised everybody because she said, you know what? This experience of being totally helpless has made me a better doctor and a better leader and a better person, because for the first time in my life did I understand what it means to be totally helpless, what my patients are going through when they are bedridden. So she took that as a growth experience. And in the early 90s, the term post-traumatic growth did not yet exist. So later, she discovered the science on post-traumatic growth and Richard Tedeschi's work. And this is what prompted her to start the Army Resilience Program and to exactly, you know, bring her experience and her research into the Army work to find out, well, why do so many soldiers not bounce forward? Why do they not heal after trauma? And what can we do to prepare people for trauma and to help them heal afterwards?
I was surprised to learn that soldiers are being taught meditation and mindfulness training
part
of all this, that really, you know, surprised me.
Yeah, me too. The first thing they did in the morning at the Army Resilience Boot Camp was they all took several minutes, they sat still, they closed their eyes, and they focused on their breath. And we're talking about 180 Army surgeons in their, you know, fatigue uniforms. So, yeah, that was one of the things that surprised me, too. And Rhonda Corner meditates every day. So we usually don't bring that together, right? Tough soldiers and meditation. But every study has found that meditation is one of the methods that helps the most. And no matter which religion or which belief someone has, whether they are Christian or Buddhist or don't believe in any God or any religion, the simple fact of sitting down, getting in touch with ourselves, bringing our mind home, focusing ourselves with our breath, calming ourselves with our breath, is useful for everybody. And it has actually been found that, for instance, physical pain can be reduced with meditation better than with morphine. It works better than painkillers. And even the physical effects of trauma, like, for instance, differences in the brain, can be mitigated with meditation. And that works pretty fast. A few weeks of meditation, daily meditation, can already lead to significant improvements.
We're speaking with Dr. Michaela Haas. She's an educator, journalist, author, and public speaker. And she's written Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to ask for your experiences and how perhaps you found out you were stronger than you thought you were. Stay with us.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. It's our Monday afternoon edition. We're visiting with Dr. Michaela Haas, and we're talking about her book, Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs. Again, our number, as Bonnie told you, 1-800-743-9576, if you'd like to join in. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.com. Michaela Haas, you talk about the difference between resilience and post-traumatic growth. Could you fill us in on that?
So the word's still out on how the two ideas are exactly related, but how I would express it is resilience literally means bouncing back. Like, we have been stressed or bent out of shape, and we're finding back to our old form. And post-traumatic growth is finding a new form or bouncing forward. So I chose that term, that title of the book, Bouncing Forward, not only because it's a quote by Maya Angelou, but also because I think that when something hard happens, we cannot really find back to our old form. We are changed, profoundly transformed. We never go back to the lives we led before we lost that loved one or before we were diagnosed with that illness. It's a profound transformation that happens. So resilience is one of the outcomes of post-traumatic growth. People who experience post-traumatic growth become more resilient. But actually, sometimes the least resilient people do experience the most post-traumatic growth. So I think that's a hopeful notion, because sometimes we think, oh, you know, other people are so resilient and I'm not like them and I'm weak. But actually, sometimes it's when everything comes crashing down, when we lose everything, that that's the opportunity to build something new and to build something better and a better foundation for our life than we had before.
You know what, Michaela, I just have to take issue with you on this one point, because, yes, it is an opportunity to grow and to change everything, and new doors can open. Yeah. But I know I've met people, and I'm sure you have, that don't use that opportunity, that go through some, you know, terrible illness or some, you know, traumatic experience and don't change.
Yes, absolutely. So not everybody grows.
Right.
But I believe that everybody can grow.
Okay.
And I take issue with scientists or journalists who tell us that people who go through a certain kind of trauma are doomed, or that trauma has to be a life sentence or has to be damaging forever. It depends on so many factors, on what someone goes through, how much they lose, and very much on who's there for them. So post-traumatic growth doesn't happen easily. It often doesn't happen immediately or quickly, and it rarely happens by itself. There are things we need to do to transform something devastating into something that becomes a growth experience.
Is there also more of a hard-edged Nietzschean philosophy in what you're talking about in the book?
What doesn't kill me makes me stronger.
Yeah.
Some of the people in the book said that. Some of the people I spoke with, they said, like, for instance, Cindy Lamb, who is one of the co-founders of MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, she said, well, the worst has happened to me. I've lost my daughter. Nothing can be as devastating as that. So I've survived that. So now I can deal with all kinds of other hardship that life has thrown at me. So there is this notion, yes, I've experienced the worst that can possibly be. So now nothing can throw me anymore. Several people have told me that.
Again, if you have your own story of overcoming a trauma or intense adversity, what were the important factors that enabled you to triumph? If you want to tell us, our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or a brief email to radio@wlrn.org. Michaela, it seems like all this began for you with your own experience of serious illness when you were in Nepal getting your PhD.
That's right. I thought I was resilient. I was traveling by myself through Asia. I had been hosting live talk shows, so I thought I was strong and resilient. And then I became very ill in Nepal. And I'm sure you've had a bad flu ever so often in your life. So imagine you get a bad flu, you're bedridden, you can't do anything, you're completely weak. And in my case, the bad flu, so to speak, lasted for 8 months. I just could not get back on my feet. And so I was surprised how badly I took that. I was not resilient at all. And that was one of the reasons I set out to ask other people how they had found resilience, because I was not holding up when I was down for the count. And all the things I thought that would help me didn't help. Like, I call it my 2 years from hell. My husband wasn't there for me. He had affairs. He couldn't deal with the fact that his young wife was suddenly, you know, bedridden and needed help. And I reached out for help, and the people I had counted on were not there for me. So that was a tough experience. But I also had other people in my life, like my grandfather that I write about in the book, who was partly paralyzed from polio. And he was one of the most loving and energetic and enthusiastic people who made a great imprint on my life. And he was also a reason I wrote this book, because I wondered, why did he become such a wonderful person despite being deeply humiliated and harassed when he grew up as a handicapped man in Nazi Germany? How did he do that? And so I think there's a lot to say about that softness and letting that suffering and that humiliation transform us, like Leonard Cohen, you know, sings about the crack that lets the light in.
Right.
And so often we think that resilience is the people who project the most strength or who hold it all together. But I found that resilience might be quite the opposite. It might be the vulnerability that we allow ourselves to be vulnerable and to admit to ourselves and others, this hurts, this is painful, and how can I deal with this and how can I heal this?
So what was the turning point for you? How did you finally turn things around for yourself?
It took several years. It was step by step. At first, everything kept getting worse and worse, both physically, but also emotionally. You know, when you're in your late 20s, you're supposed to be on top of the world, right? You're supposed to have a lot of energy and get things done and work on your career. and do things, and I couldn't. And so I would say that it took about 2 years to crawl out of that and to step by step put things back together. But also I found that, you know, physically, I'm still not the most resilient person on the planet. It has affected my health forever. So I had to find other ways. I had to work on my emotional resilience and on my mental resilience. And I find that that's true for a lot of people. We might be resilient in one area of our lives and not in another. So we can work on strengthening our resilience where it needs to be strengthened the most. It's like a muscle that strengthens with training.
What are the perils of glossing over traumas, of just sort of pretending they're not there, or just bucking it up and being tough?
I'm so glad you're bringing those up, because I think that's the greatest danger. That's the worst thing we can do with trauma or any kind of pain or setback. That, oh, it's not that bad, you know, that grin and bear. Or a lot of people will say that, oh, you know, you'll get over it. And I think the very worst thing we can do with trauma is to not acknowledge it, to not acknowledge the pain. It's like a wound. Trauma actually literally means wound. And when we have a wound, we need to tend to it and we need to take care of it. And I have spoken with several people who didn't do that. Like Rick Allen, for instance, the famous Def Leppard drummer, you know, after he had his accident and he lost his arm. He thought at first his life was over, but then his band took him back and he went on to be very successful with Def Leppard. So for about 10 years, he led a rock star life. And after 10 years, he exploded publicly. And he had to realize that there were all these issues he hadn't been dealing with. And I have found that again and again and again, that the first step in post-traumatic growth is to acknowledge the pain and to tend to it. So post-traumatic growth is not the same thing as positive thinking, like, oh, I'll be fine. It's actually quite the opposite of it. It means to go deep.
Again, our number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. We're talking about the book Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs by Dr. Michaela Haas.
Michaela, you're talking about like what Joe said about not glossing over, and you said how important that is and how important connection is. And I was thinking in both cases, do you think it's more difficult for men to do both of those things? Because, you know, Joe was saying about bucking up and just, you know, deal with it and not, you know, really go into it. I would think that men would have a lot more time expressing their vulnerability and connecting, reaching out for help.
You know, that's true. And that's actually backed up by science, because statistically, women experience more post-traumatic growth. And I think that has something to do with it. Like, for instance, 3/4 of men, when something painful happens, the first thing they do is to reach for alcohol, 75%. And 1/3 of women do that. So that's something that makes us feel better short-term for a few hours. It numbs us temporarily, but ultimately we're not dealing with what's really going on, and that's the most unhelpful thing we could possibly do.
And do you want to take that call or break?
Why don't we take a call?
Okay.
Larry in Miami. Hi there.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Larry.
Hey, yeah, I had a crazy incident with a crazy driver hit me and then dragged me down the street and ended up having to jump off the car in the hospital and all these horrible things. And as it turns out, I'm very lucky because I'm not really brain damaged from it, but I'm not even physically damaged from it because I just won't let myself be. You know, I got to get up and feed my kids and go to work. You know, we're lucky we're living in a place where the biggest issue is, are we going to drown from sea level rising? Other people are shooting at each other. And if you can, you know, I know that people truly do experience post-traumatic stress, and they manifest in a lot of different ways. But, you know, you got to find peace. That's the key, you know. It was just me chosen that day. It could have been anybody. And I'm stronger for it. Nothing will stop me.
Michaela, he looks like Larry's doing something you talk about, which is to be grateful.
And to say, I'm looking forward. So this accident has happened, and, you know, so many of us have been in car accidents and have to deal with the fallout of that, right? And to say, I'm looking forward. I'm focusing on the future and not on the past. I'm focusing on what I can do.
Don't be mistaken. I have a lot of problems as a result of it. Like, I have no short-term memory. So in my job, where my job is to remember 1,000 things,
yes.
I spend a lot of time writing stuff down.
Yeah.
You know, this is probably something I would have learned in therapy, but I just have to do it. But there's a million other ways that it's changed my life. I can't smell anymore. I mean, can you imagine if you go to Joe's and have a chopstick and lunch?
Yeah.
I can't smell that. It's like cardboard now.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm a little annoyed, but mostly thankful.
So can I ask you a question? What
sure.
helped you? What helped you get through this experience?
My kids, my wife, and my family.
Yeah.
Hmm.
My father-in-law used to take me to my appointments, and he's in worse shape than I am. And I'd see what pain he was in, and I'm like, "All right, so I'm in pain. Whatever, I'll get on." Look at him. He does it every day, and that's just what you learn from looking at those around you that have similar experiences. Unfortunately, we all know that there's a huge problem with mental treatment in this country as a result of much serious injuries than what I had. I mean, being at war is hell, you know? So people coming back here that have been there, they've seen the worst side of life. They can't just get up and just pretend that being a guy at Home Depot or even a manager at an auto dealership is any remotely near the excitement that about is. You know, there are guys that go, men and women go to work, and very exciting jobs every day and get a great thrill out of it. Once you've been at war, there's a thrill that matches it. Just there, you're just cruising through the day, you know. It's hard to readjust to that. You know, I didn't have that nightmare, but I see a lot of people do. And those are very real things. And
I agree. And that support we get.
We laugh at mental illness. We don't treat it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. It is a huge problem in this country. And what do you say about the support from your family, that's so important, from your colleagues, but also professional support, especially for people who've gone through such severe trauma.
Oh, my God, my boss is the greatest. Everyone stepped up, everybody did what they had to do, and they made sure I had a place to come back to if I was capable.
Right.
That's not life for everybody.
Well, Larry, thanks so much for calling, and
take care.
And I'm glad everything worked out. We're speaking with Dr. Michaela Huss. She's an educator, journalist, author, public speaker. We'll hear more about her Buddhism, of which she's been a practitioner for 20 years. She's written Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs. We'll be right back.
Six minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Michaela Huss. We're talking about her book, Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs. We'll go right to another call. We've got Patricia in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question for Michaela. I wanted to ask her, actually, 2 points I wanted to make. The first one is, I suffered a traumatic experience when I was 12 when my mother passed away from cancer, and my family did not take me to counseling. We didn't do any of that back then. And 30 years later, when I've had a different crisis in my life, now I'm going back to that emotional pain and the trauma and the rawness of it. And I wanted to ask her how does one know when something has been fully healed, and why is it that years later, decades later, that pain can still be there? And when will you know if that pain will be healed, and then the next crisis you'll be able to handle it the way that you should?
Michaela?
Yes. I think that, you know, that's why I talk about, I said earlier that we are profoundly changed and transformed when something like this happened. So I think it's like a wound with a scar. And even if it has healed, you know, at certain times, the pain can be triggered again. It's maybe a place in our heart that's always going to stay a little sore, or that can always be triggered. You know, that grief you felt when you were 12 years old and that you couldn't properly express back then when you were so little and there wasn't adequate help for you there when you were a child and you lost your mom. I think that pain stays with us forever as a tender place in our soul. And so I'm not surprised to hear that, you know, certain experiences trigger that for you, because that's why Richard Tedeschi calls it more vulnerable, yet stronger. So in a way, when something like this happens, we're more vulnerable. And I think that's completely normal and to be expected. And we are maybe more open and more sensitive to certain things like grief or pain or hurt. And I don't even think that's a bad thing. I just think it's an uncomfortable thing.
Right, but how can one prepare? Because crisis will continue to happen inevitably.
Yes.
With, you know, family members and deaths, especially as one ages.
Yes.
So is there a way that someone can prepare and say, okay, I think I can be strong for this now, so that it doesn't catch you off guard again?
Well, yes, I think so, absolutely. And Dao, you said, you know, at the time when this happened, when you were 12 years old, there wasn't a lot of support for you. Well, that's actually, I've heard that from a lot of people, that the support that is so important wasn't there when it happens. But we can work on becoming more resilient by building a support network and by also supporting other people. So I think the one thing we can do to prepare ourselves for traumatic events is to create a support network, to reach out to others, to be there for others, and to have people who are there for us when things get bad. So that's the most important thing we can do to fortify us for trauma. And that we best do, you know, before something happens and not after it has happened. So from that experience of being left alone when you were suffering as a child, maybe you have greater antennas for when other people are suffering or when other people are going through grief, and you can help others better. So the one thing I would say that's the most beneficial for everybody is to get together with other people who have experienced something similar. That's what people have told me again and again, and that's what I find for myself. When I meet other people who have made similar experiences and who grew from it, I go, oh, okay, I'm not crazy. They're going through something similar, and we can talk about how it's hard, but how we can also grow stronger from it.
Michaela, how has Buddhism, first of all, how did you discover Buddhism? I know you did Asian, you know, you did your work in Nepal, but, and how did that help you in overcoming your situation?
Well, discovering Buddhism was actually another impetus to write the book, because I traveled through Asia in my 20s, and I met Tibetan refugees who had lost everything. They had lost their homeland, their families. Some of them had gone through extremely cruel experiences in labor camps in China. Some of them had been tortured. And they were among the kindest, most compassionate, and most content people I had ever met. And that surprised me to no end. How could they be so compassionate? How could they be not bitter and angry about what had happened? And they had every right to be angry. So I knew that they had learned something that I wanted to learn. And that's really what got me into studies of Buddhism, because I wanted to know more about it. And so one of the things that I think Buddhism does is to not shy away from facing life fully and from being vulnerable. And I've been teaching meditation for over a decade now, and I've been practicing meditation for more than 20 years. And I find that this presence, learning to be present with whatever is the most helpful for me, because we cannot control what happens to us most of the time, but we can control how we respond to it.
Right.
And meditation and loving kindness for ourselves and for others, and practicing compassion and trying to find forgiveness rather than resorting to anger and rage, are so helpful for healing. And a lot of the people, you know, one of the most common experiences after a trauma is guilt and self-blame. Why didn't I do something different? Why did everybody else survive? And so on. And the fundamentals of loving kindness for us and for others are so helpful for that.
And we'll move along to Lois. She's in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. When I was around 18, which is quite some time ago, my mother and my sister and brother-in-law, and they were expecting their first child, were killed in an accident, and I heard it on the 7 o'clock news. Mm. And it was definitely a horrible experience. And I don't know that there's anything. This talks about making you stronger, possibly in some way, but I don't know if it's a good experience in any case. And it was Christmas. And the trees were up with all the packages and to my wife from George and all that kind of stuff.
Well, Michaela, you're not saying, and you say in the book, it's not that people want trauma or that it's a good thing ever.
No, of course not. Well, first of all, I am so sorry that this happened to you. And nobody says that a traumatic event like this or any other traumatic event is good. What I'm saying is that we can use the struggle that comes from experiencing something hard like grief and use it to get to know ourselves better, to practice more compassion for others who are going through something hard, who are suffering or grieving, to find a new perspective in life, maybe a new appreciation in life, maybe to know how fragile life is and how easily we can lose it, and to appreciate every day that we are alive.
Well, I understand all that, and I've had a lot of therapy. I didn't just deal with this on my own. But
I'm so glad to hear that.
I don't know. I have to say, though, it's something that you never forget. I can tell you that.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Thank you.
Anyway, pardon me?
Thank you for your call.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And we're really not saying, you know, everybody is growing from a trauma like this, or that, you know, that something like such a tragic accident would be something positive or has to be something positive.
Right.
This is not to put pressure on anybody to, like, grow already, you know. It's
right.
The opposite of that. It's just opening a perspective that we can use even the most harrowing experiences to discover something.
We're speaking with Dr. Michaela Haas. And she's written Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs. One more short break, and we'll come back and take more of your calls. Stay with us.
Past 1 o'clock. Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Dr. Michaela Haas. Her book is Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs. Back to our callers. Next up, it's Carlos in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. I'm a longtime listener and first-time caller.
Oh,
I wanted to share my story and my insights into recovery. In my senior year of college, I had a mental health episode and was later diagnosed with schizophrenia. I had been eating out of trash cans at college and failing to meet my basic needs, not showering, excessively rambling to myself. To give some context of my premorbid functioning, at 18 I had once been accepted into an early admission program at a medical school for being a National Hispanic Scholar. But fortunately for me, I had early intervention, access to adequate basic needs, and engagement in structured activity early on, and I've had a pretty good functional outcome. Now I'm working on my second bachelor's degree in nursing, and I've been involved in advocacy efforts for the population that I'm part of for the past several years. Mm. And these insights have already been shared, but I just wanted to highlight them because I think they're very important. You know, access to kind of pro-social role models, people in recovery that normalize the experience, that share their experience with you, has been immensely valuable for me. I've met individuals who are professors of law and psychiatry who have a diagnosis of schizophrenia and navigated similar ambitions that I have, as well as teachers and small business owners in the support group setting that I attend, you know, almost a biweekly basis. And the other important resource that I've received has been, or insight rather, has been engaging in altruistic work and activity very early on. I was encouraged to make sense of this experience of the suffering and gain meaning from it by giving back to my community. And to that end, I've done advocacy efforts, ran support groups. I'm hoping to work in behavioral health as a nurse and continue into advanced practice as a psychiatric nurse practitioner. So those have been immensely resourceful experiences for me, and thank you for letting me share that.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Carlos. And, you know, you've taken right from Michaela's book. Obviously, you came to on your own the same realizations, right, Michaela?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that. And there are so many people I spoke with who took that deep loss or that crisis or that illness to come to exactly this realization. There's nothing positive about what happened, but I can use it to help other people with that. So like Jesse Biller, who is a paralyzed surfer I interviewed for the book, he is now helping other people, other paralyzed or handicapped kids and adults, to go surfing and skating. Or Cindy Lamb, who lost their daughter because of a drunk driver, she said, "This is a devastating experience, but I can use it to make our roads safer and to prevent other kids and other people from being killed by drunk drivers." So Bob Dylan called it the magic formula, and Jesse Biller, the surfer, says something very similar. He says, when people ask him what helped him make it through this terrible accident that left him paralyzed, go and find somebody who's worse off than you are. There's always somebody who's worse off. And that can actually give a totally new meaning to your own life. And I'm so glad you're sharing your experience and that you're becoming a nurse and using your own experience of mental health to help others.
Well, Maya Angelou was a big influence on you. In fact, she's in the title of the book somewhat. Tell us of her post-traumatic growth, just a synopsis.
Well, you know, I've admired her for a very long time, but her life is really like a course book in post-traumatic growth, because she not only grew up, I mean, her mom pretty much abandoned her when she was 3.5 years old. She pretty much put her in a train and sent her off across the country just with her little brother. And then she was raped when she had just turned 8 years old. So as a young girl, she experienced terrible sexual abuse.
I believe it was a relative also, wasn't it?
It was an uncle.
Yeah.
And she stopped speaking after that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was also the time nobody was able to deal with that experience for her. Her mother, you know, resorted to beating her up because that stubborn girl wouldn't speak after that happened. So we've come so far in learning more about trauma and dealing better with it. But at the time, you know, Maya Angelou experienced no help. And then, of course, she grew up in the racially segregated South with a lot of racism and a lot of violence. And to me, that she managed to come out of that and finding her voice, and also finding her voice for other survivors of all kinds of abuse, including right. sexual abuse, and to not resort to anger. She did for a short while, but eventually to find forgiveness and to be a voice that speaks up for harmony and for forgiveness and for healing, that's a tremendous accomplishment.
And we'll take another caller. This is Miriam. She's in Miami. Hi.
Hey there. I definitely subscribe to so much of what everyone is saying here. My personal experience was, I'll just share, I had two significant pregnancy losses. The first one was a 9-month stillbirth that was very unexpected. Yeah. And then about 2 years later, I had twins. And I remember when I was in the hospital already knowing that they had passed, and I was, you know, in labor for basically 2 days straight in the hospital. But I had a room to myself, and in the middle of the night, you know, my boyfriend's sleeping, my mother's already sleeping, you know, they're fast asleep, and I'm awake with pain. And in the next room, I can hear a birth, and I remember that so clearly, just being, you know, everybody was quiet. It was probably 3 o'clock in the morning, and next door, someone's giving birth, and you hear the nurses, and they're all helping push, and they're all, you know, there. And I remember the feeling of just that, wow, they have no idea what's going on in the next room, that I have, you know, two you know, dead, you know, babies and, you know, what I'm going through, yet, you know, and they're celebrating something next door. And it was the only thing I could do was I was happy for them, you know, that I'm going through something, but next door is something wonderful that's happening and it's just going to change, you know, their lives and they're looking forward to that. And after that, it really helped me. I consider myself an empath anyway, but it really heightened my sense of compassion in general because it really made me see things that even in my happiest moment that I'm going to have celebrating something, you know, in another day, someone else is having the worst day of their lives. You know, and it's something that I don't think everyone should necessarily keep that in mind and be a Debbie Downer in their lives and just think of, you know, the worst thing when they're themselves having, you know, the best thing in their lives. But it just was so eye-opening that, you know, when we feel that we're so alone and why is this happening to me? And, you know, just to really just open and globally think, you know, that it's just, it's completely alternate side in the other, you know, in the other spectrum. You know, and then when we have that, you know, great, we get that job, you know, for example, someone else didn't get the job, you know, and right. I just feel that it's this connection that sometimes we lack when we have trauma, that it's so insular. It's just, you know, if you just open and realize that it is, community is, I don't think the right word, but it's just, we are so connected. And I think that, you know, there's something to be felt for everyone, you know, that in every moment of every second, you know, something horrible and something amazing is happening, you know, and it could be you one day and it could, you know, be not you the next day.
Right.
So,
Michaela?
That's helped me.
That's great. Michaela?
That's beautifully said, because I think we, all of us, experience both, you know, the fullness of life, the heights and the lows. And that, to see that, you know, I always think when someone is acting out or when someone is suffering, I find that my experience of illness or hardship has made me more attuned to what other people go through and to live, you know, the roller coaster ride of life that can get us so high and can bring us so low, to feel what other people are going through and to be there for them and to connect with them, to not shy away from doing it when they're hitting the lows or when we are hitting the lows, and to also be able to celebrate the goodness of life. It's all of that. That's, you know, the patchwork of life. It's the suffering and the joys both together.
Michaela, before we go, what is Haas Live? I went to Haas Live, haas-live.com, but it was only in German.
Well, I am originally from Germany, though I live in America now.
Right.
And so I've founded a coaching company that I've been doing for 15 years now, and that started because as a TV host and journalist, I was asked to do presentation training and media training for people, but I'm also including mindfulness training in that because I found that so many leaders who come to me for presentation or media training, actually mindfulness is so helpful for them to learn to be present, to learn to deal with life's challenges or job's challenges with awareness and with empathy is actually a concept that has become more and more popular in business as well. And I love doing that. I have a program called Wisdom at Work. So it doesn't just focus on the material success, but also on how are we dealing with challenges
right.
in business.
Well, thank you, Dr. Michaela Haas.
Thank you.
An educator, journalist, author. She's written Bouncing Forward, Transforming Bad Breaks into Breakthroughs. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a wonderful conversation.
Our pleasure.
And thank you for listening. Our producer, Richard Ives, technical direction, online producer, Paul Leary. If you didn't catch the whole program, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, Bonnie and I examine how groundbreaking museums help preserve cultural heritage. We'll focus on Miami's Haitian Heritage Museum with its co-founder, Serge Rodriguez, and its executive director, Evelyn Pierre, as well as the director and CEO of History Miami, that's Stuart Chase. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now. That's next from NPR News.